This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, time is running out for hunger-striking footballer Mahmoud Sarsak as rights groups demand urgent pressure on Israel, which has reneged on agreements made last month during the mass hunger strikes in Israeli jails. We'll have updates from Ali Abunima on this developing story. Also, villagers in the South Hebron Hills are determined to remain on their land despite home demolitions by Israel. Campaigners for Palestinian refugees' right of return strategize in South Africa and learn from the post-apartheid struggle there. In a blow to Zionist censors, California's attorney general backs a professor's right to call for an Israel boycott on his state university website. And news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, associate editor for the Electronic Intifada in Berkeley. Time is running out for hunger striker Mahmoud Sarsak, a football player on the Palestinian national team who has been refusing food for more than 80 days. Sarsak has been protesting his indefinite imprisonment without charge or trial under Israel's so-called unlawful combatants law. And according to more than a dozen health and human rights groups, the former star athlete now weighs a little over 100 pounds and is close to death. He began his hunger strike on March 19th. Akram Rikawi has also been on sustained hunger strike for nearly 60 days in Ramleh prison, where he and Sarsak are both held. He is also close to 100 pounds and is suffering severe critical health problems. The Electronic Intifada reported on Tuesday that a statement put out by Physicians for Human Rights Israel and the 12 groups making up the Palestinian Council of Human Rights Organizations emphasized the urgent need for both Sarsak and Rikawi to be transferred to civilian hospitals, something Israel has refused to do. Mahmoud Sarsak, 25 years old, is a member of the Palestinian national football team who was detained by Israeli forces nearly 3 years ago and held without charge, trial, or judicial process. Rikawi has been held in the Ramleh Prison Medical Center since his arrest in 2004. The Electronic Intifada has posted an urgent distress call written by Sarsak and Rikawi, which included the statement, quote, "We say there is still enough time, and the support that comes late is better than that which does not come at all. It is better that you receive us alive and victorious rather than as lifeless bodies in black bags." To read the entire letter, visit electronicintifada.net/blogs. Our correspondent Lina Al-Safan reported on Tuesday that since the mass hunger strikes by Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails officially ended on May 15th after an agreement was signed by the Israeli Prison Service and representatives of the Palestinian prisoners, Israel has already violated several of the agreements. One of the main intentions of the mass hunger strike was to bring attention to Israel's rampant use of administrative detention. As Al-Safan reported, quote, "The signed agreement led many to believe that Israel would curtail its use of administrative detention, especially after it announced that all administrative detainees would be released at the end of their current detention periods, unless substantial evidence was provided against them. However, 2 weeks after the agreement, more than 25 prisoners have had their detentions renewed without such significant evidence presented. Among these prisoners is Hussein Abu Kuwaik, who spent a total of 12 years in prison and survived an assassination attempt that killed his wife and three of his sons in 2002. Abu Kuwaik's latest arrest was on May 31, 2011, and his detention has been renewed for another 6 months. Other violations are still taking place away from the media spotlight. A spokesperson for the Palestinian Prisoners Club said that prisoners have been subjected to humiliating strip searches in several Israeli prisons, and there are a number of prisoners who remain in solitary confinement, as Israel obviously continues the punitive measures that it had agreed to end. There are now rumors that another mass hunger strike may be in the works. For more on the story, we go to the Electronic Intifada's Ali Abunima in Chicago. Ali, give us an update on the health situation of Mahmoud Sarsak and Akram Rikawi. What's the latest news we have so far?
Well, the latest news is what came to us from Physicians for Human Rights and the joint statement from that group and the Palestinian Human Rights Group. On June 6th, there was the first visit by an independent doctor to Mahmoud Sarsak and Akram Rikawi since the hunger strike began, and the independent physician confirmed really the dire health situation of both men. Mahmoud Sarsak had been on hunger strike 80 days when the doctor saw him, And this young man, who is a star athlete, has lost 33% of his body weight, so just over 100 kilos, as the report said, and is suffering from frequent incidents of fainting and loss of consciousness and memory lapses. And the independent physician reported that he's in danger of pulse disruptions and arrhythmias that could endanger his life at any moment. As for Akram Nikhawi, the Physicians for Human Rights Israel doctor said that he's already suffered from extreme loss of muscle tissue and also drastic weight loss. He's lost just over 26% of his body weight. And the issue with Akram Nikhawi, who had been on hunger strike some 60 days when the doctor saw him, is that he has suffered from severe chronic illnesses for a number of years. So his health was already very vulnerable.
Now, Ali, this points to the fact that almost immediately after the Israeli Prison Service signed agreements that it would ease certain restrictions that it had placed upon Palestinian prisoners across Israeli jails, they've started to violate these agreements. What does this mean in terms of the ongoing hunger strike and struggles by Palestinian prisoners and their families to demand justice here?
Well, that's right. As you remember, 28 days after 2,000 Palestinian prisoners started the hunger strike, that started on Palestinian Prisoners Day on April 17th, there was a deal which was supposed to deal with a number of demands of the hunger strikers, including ending the use of solitary confinement, ending the widespread use of administrative detention. And in the case of prisoners who were already in administrative detention, not renewing their administrative detention orders unless there was compelling evidence that they'd actually done something to merit being arrested. There were also other provisions to do with family visits. Visits from Gaza families have been banned for almost 5 years. If you think about Mahmoud Farsak, for example, who's been in jail without charge or trial for 3 years, he's not seen his family through all that period of detention, and there are many hundreds of other prisoners in that situation. But what has happened since the deal was signed is that there have been consistent reports of numerous administrative detention orders renewed in violation of the deal. One prisoner, Sam El-Barak, who is in administrative detention, restarted his hunger strike some 2 weeks ago because instead of being released as he was supposed to under the deal, he was handed another 3 months administrative detention order.
What's the significance of rumors now that Palestinian prisoners might resume a hunger strike because of these violations?
Well, we've heard those reports and rumors. I don't think we can say that until such a thing happens. But I think what's clear to say is that as many of the prisoners' families and those who've met prisoners and ex-prisoners themselves have said, that this is an ongoing struggle. Nobody believed that this hunger strike, as historic as it was, the mass hunger strike, would be the end of it. Israel is very determined in continuing with a whole range of violations. And by the way, I think two things that are worth pointing out in recent days that have come out. One is a report from Amnesty International, a major report on Israel's use of administrative detention, detailing the widespread abuse of this system of detention without charge or trial. And the other is a report from Ad-Damir on the Israeli military court system that has just come out. So I think one of the things that the hunger strikes have definitely achieved, if not all the rights of the prisoners, is bringing a lot more international attention to the systematic abuses of Palestinian prisoners' rights. But I don't think anyone was under the illusion that the battle could be won like that. And we have to remember that for Mahmoud Farsak and Akram Nikhawi, it's really a very critical situation, and that's been underscored in the urgency of the appeal that came from the Palestinian human rights groups in the statement the other day.
That was Ali Abu Nima speaking to us from Chicago. For more on this story, visit electronicintifada.net. In the occupied West Bank, our correspondent Lydia James reported from the South Hebron Hills that communities in the shadow of illegal Israeli settlement colonies and the Israeli military are fighting to remain on their land despite regular threats of home and land demolitions. James reported that the 150-person village of Al-Mufakara is one of a dozen communities situated in the South Hebron Hills region within a 7.5-acre Israeli military firing zone adjacent to the 1967 Green Line, the internationally recognized armistice line between Israel and the occupied West Bank. Attempts to force the community out began at the end of the 1990s, even though the firing zone was established during the 1970s. The isolation and eviction of communities here indicate Israel's plans to annex this region. Four Israeli settlements and, quote, outposts surround the village. All are illegal under international law. The villagers experience frequent settler violence. Al-Mufakara, like many villages in the South Hebron Hills, is in Area C, which was placed under full Israeli control by the Oslo Accords, though supposedly on a temporary basis. Area C covers more than 60% of the West Bank, and in this area, Palestinians have to request permits from Israeli authorities to build any structure, even tents and wells, and permits are almost never granted. Two women were arrested last November when they attempted to save belongings from their homes in Al-Mufakara as they were being demolished. The next day, a number of men from other communities in the area began rebuilding the mosque. This year, the same solidarity and determination was seen on May 19th at the launch of a campaign by Palestine's Popular Struggle Coordination Committee to support the community of Al-Mufakara in its struggle to keep living on its land. The residents of Al-Mufakara have expressed their wish to live above ground rather than below it. Therefore, the first of 15 houses, one for each family, was built on May 19th. The campaign will continue and people will meet every week until all of the homes are completed. Many communities that in the last few years have benefited from solar panels and wind turbines have had these and other structures demolished. Havat Ma'on, a settlement outpost that is illegal even under Israeli law, by contrast enjoys easy access to electricity and water. By defying pending demolition orders and a de facto prohibition on building Palestinian homes, the residents of Al-Mufakara emphasize their right to remain on their land and to oppose Israeli policies of displacement. For more on Lydia James's story, visit electronicintifada.net. In February, a delegation of activists and scholars working on the Palestinian right of return came together in Cape Town, South Africa, to discuss the practicalities of return 64 years and counting since the forced expulsion of more than 750,000 Palestinians in 1947 and 48. Participants also learned from South Africa's experience of implementing its return of internally displaced blacks after white minority rule officially ended in the mid-1990s. Delegates were affiliated with Badil, the Bethlehem-based Palestinian Center for Residency and Refugee Rights, and Zohrot, the Israeli anti-Zionist organization dedicated to educating the Israeli public about the Nakba, the systematic ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in the 1940s, and the right of return. Following the workshops in Cape Town, delegates worked on discussion papers on the right of return, which have been published in Badil's English-language quarterly magazine, Al-Majdal. The Electronic Intifada interviewed Hazem Jemjoum, a delegate to Cape Town and the editor of Al-Majdal. He talked about strategizing for Palestinian refugee rights against the physical and historical backdrop of South Africa's anti-apartheid struggle, some of the discussions and plans that came out of the workshops, the feasibility of implementing the right of return, and what the next steps are in realizing the return of Palestinian refugees. To read the interview, visit electronicintifada.net. Following up on a story we did months back, the Electronic Intifada's Ali Abu Nima reported this week that the Office of California Attorney General Kamala Harris has rejected a request by a Zionist group to prosecute a professor at California State University at Northridge for, quote, misuse of state resources because he uses university servers to host a website on which he campaigns for the boycott of Israel. Professor David Klein has been at the center of an attack campaign by Zionist lobby groups because of his organizing in opposition to the California State University system's resumption of a study abroad program in Israel and his outspoken support of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. In April, an organization calling itself the Global Frontier Justice Center asked the California Attorney General to investigate and prosecute Klein. The Global Frontier Justice Center, as the Electronic Intifada noted, has no official listing for a 501c3 nonprofit under that name, and under further investigation, it would appear that it is a front for Shirat Hadin, a well-funded far-right Israeli lawfare group known as the Israel Law Center. Among Shirat Hadin's efforts to stifle the Palestinian Solidarity Movement was its filing of spurious legal complaints in Greece, intended to stop flotilla boats from sailing to Gaza last summer. And according to journalist Max Blumenthal, Shirat Hadin is partly funded by John Hagee, the Islamophobic, anti-Semitic, and homophobic radical Christianist founder of Christians United for Israel. Professor David Klein told Ali Abu Nima on Tuesday that he was pleased and surprised by the decision of the Attorney General not to prosecute him, which he learned of by letter. Klein said, quote, "I saw the letter in my mailbox and thought, uh-oh, here we go. But then I opened it and heaved a sigh of relief. I hope that it is a source of encouragement to other faculty members to do similar things, to go ahead and take a public stand against apartheid in Israel and ethnic cleansing and all the injustices there." For more on this important story, visit electronicintifada.net/blogs. We now go to news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. The student government at Arizona State University took a powerful stand on the last day of the school year last week when it unanimously passed a bill, quote, demanding that ASU divest from and blacklist companies that continue to provide the Israeli army with weapons and militarized equipment or are complicit with the genocidal regime in Darfur. In a press announcement, Students for Justice in Palestine's ASU chapter stated, "This announcement, coming on the last day of the 2012 school year, is another victory in the global call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions on Israel, as well as other global solidarity movements calling for the end to human rights violations." Arizona State University, a university with an endowment of over $735 million, aspires to be the new American university with globally engaged students. We, students at ASU, want our university to make socially responsible investment decisions. We also want ASU's investments to reflect its values as an institution. The bill calls for ASU to divest from and blacklist companies such as Alliant Tech Systems, Boeing, Caterpillar, Motorola, United Technologies, PetroChina, China National Petroleum Company, Sinopec, Oil and Natural Gas Company, and Alstom. ASU has been a flashpoint of cross-struggle student activism as students from Latino and Latina groups and Students for Justice in Palestine and students in solidarity with both have come together in support of global social justice and human rights. In March, students from MECHA, Movimiento Estudiantil Chicano de Aztlán, the largest Latino-Latina group in the U.S., voted overwhelmingly to endorse BDS following the previous BDS endorsement by ASU's own MECHA chapter. Students have also constructed a mock wall on campus to bring attention to both the militarized wall Israel has built in the West Bank and the militarized wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. And last year, legendary scholar Dr. Cornel West lent his support to the student groups at ASU who worked to support BDS and the threatened ethnic studies classes on campus. Meanwhile, in another victory on a U.S. college campus, the Flaming Eggplant Cafe, a student-run collective at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, voted on June 4th to boycott Israeli goods. The local student-led BDS group, TESC Divest, stated on its website that, quote, "According to the Flaming Eggplant's mission statement, one of the cafe's goals is to nourish the local food system by making delicious, healthy, ecologically and socially just food accessible to all." In its statement of principles, the collective also expresses its commitment to supporting political participation and direct action to create a just and egalitarian society. The office coordinator of the Flaming Eggplant Cafe said, quote, "We came to a consensus as a collective to support the Palestinian civil society call for BDS because it is directly in line with our mission and statement of principles." He added, "We are proud to join this nonviolent movement to pressure Israel until it ends its human rights violations against Palestinians." For more on the global BDS movement, visit electronicintifada.net/tags/BDS. And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, pointed opinion and analysis, and action alerts by our team of correspondents and bloggers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. This week, be sure to check out our Month in Pictures feature, a collection of rich photographs curated from some of the best photographers and agencies working in and around Palestine, and see a preview of Flying Paper, a forthcoming documentary which tells the moving story of Palestinian children in Gaza who broke the Guinness World Record for most kites simultaneously flown. The film was co-produced with young filmmakers in Gaza. At electronicintifada.net, you can also send comments and sign up for our daily newsletter. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and a special thanks to Flashpoints and KPFA in Berkeley. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.